The people of Alabama understand what's going on here. My husband, Judge Roy Moore, is fighting for the people of Alabama and has been fighting for over 30 years. The people of Alabama know him. Big wheels, come on, turn. So to the people of Alabama, thank you for being smarter than they think you are. They will call you names. They will say all manner of evil against you. And I would say, consider the source.
Welcome to Radio Free America on Blog Talk Radio with your hosts, Will McVeigh the Younger, Jess McVeigh the Elder, and Julia Rose Rebecca McVeigh the Youngest. Roy Moore ain't going anywhere. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about tax reform and a few other things. Thanks for joining us. Well, welcome, listeners. And this time, I really meant it. Julia is with us, if you couldn't tell during the intro.
She'll introduce herself at some point.
I think she already did, if I'm not mistaken.
There she is.
Yeah, there she is. Welcome aboard, Julia.
Hello. Yes, I'm here.
So we're going to come back and talk about Roy Moore and all the other ramifications of Roy Moore in a little bit. We want to cover some other things before we go there, just because there is actually some other stuff going on in the world, and probably prudent that we discuss those things first. Briefly, I want to mention Saudi Arabia because we talked about it last time. Some funny things going on there in terms of the house arrest for multiple of the princelings and some of the businessmen. There are rumors now that King Salman will announce his abdication sometime during the coming week and the elevation of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the kingship. What is it called?
The crown.
The crown, yeah.
King hasn't been king for long, has he?
Salman, a couple years.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Like Abdullah, the king before that was like king forever.
Yeah, Abdullah, he'd been king for quite a while. He's very old and frail. And
but then he
died? I think he actually abdicated too.
He abdicated
too?
I mean, you know, I'm not going to begrudge the Saudi king his right to retire.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's quite what's happening in this particular case. This seems a little bit more intriguing.
Well, I think I get the impression that Salman is actually retiring voluntarily, if that's in fact what he does.
Well, he's not nearly as old, though. Like, he hasn't been king for nearly as long.
But he was old when he started, and he's old and frail. So the point is,
okay.
The intrigue comes in that it's only been, I think, less than a year since he named a new successor. It had been somebody else, and now this guy, Mohammed bin Salman, is the current successor. And
he's the guy that's house arresting everybody.
Yeah, and he's got the reputation for being a reformer. He's also the guy that was in charge of the people that are arresting everybody. So we'll see what happens. And again, the speculation is that sometime next week, the king will actually abdicate and Mohammed bin Salman will actually be the king. So just consolidating his power in multiple ways. I don't know what the status is of these people that were under house arrest. I thought I heard at some point...
Hey, when you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die.
I was looking up... I intended to look up and didn't get a chance to do it because I've had a busy afternoon. I thought I read something or heard some rumor that Salman was offering some of these guys that had been arrested some sort of leniency or amnesty if they would donate a certain amount of money or something.
Bendy knee.
Yeah, he was basically holding them ransom.
There's a joke in about season 7 of Game of Thrones because Daenerys Targaryen keeps asking Jon Snow to bend the knee. He's like, bendy knee, and that's basically what this. I mean, that's basically what this sounds like to me. Like this sounds like you're under arrest. You know, kiss the ring, show fealty. bendy knee to the new king, and you'll be and you'll be released.
Yeah, and pay up.
Well, I mean, that's just, I mean, these are rich people anyway. Like, I don't imagine that any sort of contribution is really going to break them. But the bottom line is that it's a demonstration of that fealty. Like, you know, back in the Middle Ages, they used to make you get down on one knee and literally pledge an oath of fealty. At this point, they make you write a check. It's kind of the same difference.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on from that, also going on in Saudi Arabia, we mentioned last week that the Prime Minister of Lebanon was presumed under house arrest in Saudi Arabia. His name is Saeed Hariri. He's now in Paris, and he's basically claiming that he's going to be going home to Lebanon sometime soon to establish his political position. But the speculation is that, you know, he's not going to go back to Lebanon for fear of his life. But he is actually not being held prisoner in Saudi Arabia any longer, if in fact he ever was.
He did officially resign, though, right? So, like, he was going back to Lebanon to establish his political position. That means basically he's going to have to seek a new one, right?
I don't know what it means. All I can tell you is that he resigned, and then he resigned it under duress.
I mean, presumably, as long as he's in Paris, he's not under duress at the moment. Like, the French authorities, at the very least, are going to protect him from, you know, Saudi head chopping. So, like, if he was really under duress when he resigned, like, he would feel free to say what he wants to say while he's in France.
Well, that's the presumption, but who knows what other elements the Saudis could have to enforce his, you know, towing the line.
I don't know, they have his brother or something, don't they? Like,
I don't know. He's in Paris with his family, but I'm sure there's somebody in Saudi Arabia that he doesn't want to have lose their head. So who knows how much of a free will he has here. But anyway, that's a developing story. It's worth keeping an eye on because, as we mentioned, the speculation is that, thank you, Julia.
She thinks it's fascinating.
The speculation is that this is a prelude to war. Saudi Arabia has a problem with Iran, and the concern is that, you know, there could end up being a proxy war in Lebanon with Saudi forces and Israeli forces basically squaring off against Hezbollah, who is supported by Iran. And along those lines, kind of in support of that possibility, there was an item in the paper, I put a link in the program notes, the chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, Lieutenant General Gadi Eisenkot, actually did an interview with a Saudi newspaper, which in and of itself is very unusual, if not unprecedented. And he said, yeah, we wouldn't have any objection to sharing certain amounts of intelligence with the Saudi government.
Wow.
So, again, this turned some heads. Again, it kind of adds to the speculation that perhaps we may be seeing something going forward in Lebanon with the Israelis and the Saudis, as I said, squared off against the
Iranians.
Yeah.
And probably think the Syrians will have anything to do with it at this point?
I don't know if the... I don't know. I mean
Assad's definitely got some other things going on in his mind, but...
Right. But he is a client of the Iranians, so I'm sure that it's something...
Well, that, and he's a long-term meddler in Lebanon. Like, he's got interests in Lebanon, presumably. Like, he's usually he's the conduit, obviously, just geographically for Iran into Lebanon. So, I mean, presumably he would have some kind of involvement, and that's why the Saudis feel more empowered to do something in Lebanon, because he's been weakened and he's not as able to exert control over the supply line between Iran and Lebanon.
I suppose that's possible, but like I say, right now all we have is little bits and pieces and speculation. We'll have to wait and see what happens. I want to move on to discuss a little bit about tax reform. There's a little bit of ill will in the Senate. I don't know. Everybody's been playing this soundbite between Orrin Hatch and Sherrod Brown from Ohio. So I'm going to play the short version. This is just pretty much just Orrin Hatch, and we'll come back and talk after that.
But I'm going to just say to you that I come from the poor people, and I've been here working my whole stinking career for people who don't have a chance. And I really resent anybody saying that I'm just doing this for the rich. Give me a break. I think you guys overplay that all the time, and it gets old. And frankly, you ought to quit it.
Mr. Chairman, the public...
No, wait a minute. I'm not through. Okay. I get kind of sick and tired of it. True, it's a nice political play.
Well, Mr. Chairman...
But it's not true.
What do we do before we learn this?
Listen, I've honored you by allowing you to spout off here. And what you said was not right. That's all I'm saying. I come from the lower middle class originally. We didn't have anything. So don't spew that stuff on me. I get a little tired of that crap. Now, all I can say is I like you personally very much, but I'm telling you, this bullcrap that you guys throw out here really gets old after a while. To do it right at the end of this was just not right. And it takes a lot to get me worked up like this.
The Senate's known for their collegial nature and their proper language, and this is very out of character for Orrin Hatch. And I only played the Hatch portion of this. I could have played Sherrod Brown's responses, and he said something that initiated in a hearing in the Senate, the markup hearing for the tax bill. And I don't think he was necessarily wrong from his point of view. Sherrod Brown was talking about, let's just not kid ourselves that this is for the middle class. It's really to help the rich. And Orrin Hatch sounded like he was offended by that, but the rich make out pretty well in this. So
yeah,
I'm not a class war warrior. I don't have a problem with rich people benefiting from tax reform along with everybody else. But it's just unusual that it head to head the way they did. And so I thought I wanted to play a little bit about that. So the confrontation that took place at the Senate hearing was a little bit unusual. It's not quite how it goes in the Senate. I guess it's a sign of the tension that's going on between the two parties. Because basically the Republicans have decided if the Democrats are going to stonewall us on this, we're going to write our own bill. We'll have to just accept the criticism that comes along with it. But, if they don't want input because they're not going to vote yes for anything, then why even bother with them? Just, let them speak their mind and move on and do what we're going to do anyway.
So now, is that likely to be filibustered? Because they don't have the numbers to overrule a filibuster, do they?
This is all going to happen under reconciliation, so they don't. It's filibuster proof, but they do have to get 50 votes plus one, and that in itself can be a challenge because there are some senators that have voiced opposition to various aspects of the bill. So it's not a done deal. The House has passed their version, so it's passed the House with a fairly significant margin. They had some Republican defections. A lot of the Republicans from the larger blue states like California, New Jersey, and New York voted no because the House version eliminates
personal exemptions.
No, they both do that. It eliminates state and local income tax deductions, and it reduces the amount of deductions you can make for large mortgages. So,
well, those are all part of the personal exemptions, aren't they? Or is that
no? Personal exemption is the thing where just for breathing air, you get to deduct a certain amount from your taxable income.
Okay, kind
of deductions is different from exemptions.
Okay,
yeah.
And this is my little tax exemption, right? So I wouldn't get...
Yeah, she's your tax exemption.
So if they eliminate personal tax exemptions, she's no longer valuable to the IRS.
She's of no value. Little girls have absolutely no value whatsoever. That's funny, huh?
That's funny.
So anyhow, the House passed their version. The Senate is trying to get their version. It's apparently going to go to the floor. It passed the committee in the Senate, and it's supposed to go to the floor after Thanksgiving, and that's when people start bandying back and forth about this and that. So I wanted to take a few minutes to talk about the differences between the bills, because we tried to do that last week. We didn't really get into much detail, and I think it's worth spending some time doing that. My feeling is that the primary purpose of this tax reform bill is to lower the corporate tax rate. The current tax rate is 35%. Both bills in the House and Senate lower it to 25%. They lower it to 20%.
I think there's value in that.
Yeah, economically it makes good sense, but it's a very easy thing to demagogue on the parts of the Democrats, and they're taking advantage of that opportunity. The Senate bill is different from...
I think that when you're talking about the corporate tax rate in particular, I think that the Laffer curve really does start to take effect, because that's basically competition between governments.
Yeah.
And especially when you're dealing, with multinational corporations that, may or may not have to worry about a VAT because that was one of the things that you posted, I think, at one point, talking about how, the corporate tax rate may be higher in the U.S., but we don't have a VAT, whereas all these other countries do with a lower tax rate. But if you're a multinational company and you're incorporated in a foreign country with a lower corporate tax rate, but you do a lot of business in the United States, then you don't pay VAT or the 35% corporate tax rate. So, it's kind of a best of both worlds there a little bit. And if you lower the corporate tax rate here, so that more, companies end up incorporating in Delaware because of our corporate laws and quarter chancery and all the other reasons why people incorporate in Delaware, a little bit of an advertisement for the state there, I guess.
Yeah.
Then, those taxes basically will come into the United States rather than coming into, whatever foreign country they're incorporating in currently. I think that the Laffer curve really does probably play more of a role when it comes to corporate tax rates, because it's not so much that, there's a dollar for dollar, we're not going to tax it, so it's going to go into the economy and grow. I think it's it's honestly more than that, because, you know, you lower the corporate tax rate and all of a sudden you're competitive with these other countries that are getting the bulk of the corporate taxes instead. So it's basically 0 to 20% instead of, you know, 35 to 20.
Well, that's the position that the Republicans are taking, because they say that the reason they want to do that is so that they can grow the economy. And they're suggesting if you use dynamic scoring instead of static scoring, that that growth in the economy will well make up for the increased deficits that would occur if you scored it statically.
Well, that being
said,
based on the
fact that they're reducing so many taxes.
Like, I did just say that I think that there's a very strong Laffer curve effect here, but at the same time, the idea that you can measure it, I don't think is necessarily credible.
Well, there are different economists that, you know, put together these models and claim that they have at least some way to estimate it, but you're right. It's just an estimate and can't be taken.
Economists are probably about as credible as social scientists.
Yeah, almost. They're almost as bad, yeah. So anyway, did I mention that the Senate version of the bill delays the onset of the tax reduction for corporations by a year? And they do that to save some money because they're giving some money back in other places. So in other words, the Senate bill is a little more generous
save
to
some
the
money.
Individuals.
That seems a little contradictory if the whole idea
I don't want to get into that. You know, to basically say they have to shift money around. So if they take it from one place, they have to put it somewhere else. So they lose less revenue by delaying that corporate tax reduction by a year.
Using static scoring.
Yeah, and then they take that money and they put it towards things in the Senate bill that the House bill took away that they don't take away. Things like deductions for medical, deductions for student loans, and difference in treatments of the mortgage deduction and whatnot, the larger child tax credit. Both the House and the Senate bills treat money or cash being repatriated by businesses from overseas special manner. There's a 14% rate under the House bill, and the Senate taxes it at a lower 10% rate, opposed to, you know, even the 20% rate that they're lowering income taxes to for other things. So that's an aspect of the bill that I didn't know. They're giving special treatment to these mountains of cash that are being held overseas right now. We talked earlier about the different number of brackets.
That's another fairly strong Laffer curve argument for that, though, because, like, if you don't lower that rate, they're just going to keep it overseas, and it does absolutely nothing for the domestic economy.
Well, that's the claim anyway, yeah. Again, we mentioned that the number of tax brackets are different in the two plans. The House version has only four brackets, 10%, 25%, 35%, and 39.6%. The Senate would keep the existing seven bracket structure, but they lower the rates. The rates would be lowered to 10, 12, 22, 24, 32, 35, and 38.5. So that's a difference in the bills, and that can end up making a significant difference to some people, I'm sure.
See, I think there's less of a Laffer effect on those, though.
Yeah. The other thing is, and this is something that the Democrats have chosen to demagogue as well, is that the Senate bill makes the individual tax cuts temporary, while the House plan makes them permanent. The corporate tax reductions are permanent in both plans.
Interesting.
So well, again, it's a means of saving money. Because the way they score it, they say, oh, well, at a certain point in time, the tax rates go back up for the individual tax reform. So it means they're not costing as much money.
Right.
But their claim is, oh, but that's the Republicans actually admit that that's a gimmick so that it could come in under the budget limit of $1.5 trillion mm-hmm. added to the deficit over whatever time frame it is. They say, in reality, no Congress is going to vote to raise taxes on individuals. And that may be true, but the corollary to that is they're basically admitting that it's a gimmick, that it's going to raise the deficit more than it
yeah.
claims to. We're taking advantage of this gimmick so that it will, you know, pass muster for reconciliation. And in reality, there's going to be a bigger deficit created by our tax bill than we're saying there is, because we all know, wink, wink, that it's going to get renewed when it expires.
If anything, too, like when you look at what the projected, you know, revenue and deficit and whatever is going to be, like I mentioned with the whole Laffer effect of the corporate tax rate, like it should play out that, you know, if the Laffer curve really has any impact on any of this at all, that, you know, lowering the corporate tax rate is going to prove to be such a boon to the economy that it's going to be the best, most brilliant idea the Republicans passed during Trump's entire administration, because the guy himself is a buffoon. So, like, this is going to be the best idea that they've had. And, you know, if they made that temporary instead, that presumably any Congress would be like, yeah, look at all the money we're making. It'd be really, really stupid for us to let this, you know, continue to happen as to let this lapse, to let this revert back to the original rate. But it's just so easy to be like, you know, yeah, well, you're leaving individuals out in the cold here. Like, this is obviously a gimmick, whereas, you know, this one that's, you know, more of a cash cow probably, and also incidentally easier to demagogue as, you know, being a handout to the rich.
That's the issue, is the demagogue.
And also, by the way, more likely to have a laffer effect of, you reduce the rate, you're going to actually get more growth, as opposed to you reduce the rate and a couple of rich people are going to buy more yachts. You know, it seems to me that seems to me like a strategic error, that they should make the corporate tax rate the one that is temporary.
Well, I don't agree with you, because politically I think that's a poor idea. They want to make sure that happens. And, you know, if that were to expire, there's significant concern that, you know, the Democrats, when first opportunity they'd get, would raise the taxes again on the corporations. So they want that to be, or they would fail to renew the reduction. So they think that politically it's much more likely that the individual reduction would get renewed when it had to be renewed, as opposed to the corporate rate. And that's why they're positive of that.
I suppose so, but I still feel like there's less to be gained in a real, like, I feel like the corporate tax rate changes adjustments would justify themselves more easily in the long term.
Yeah, but we're talking about Democrats and the whole class warfare means of doing politics. So I'm sure that's the Republican strategy, and I kind of agree with it. Moving on with some things in the two bills. Both versions of the bill would immediately double the lifetime exemption for the estate tax to about $11 million for individuals and $22 million for couples. The difference between the two is that the Senate version keeps the tax at that higher threshold, whereas the House bill eliminates it completely in 2024. So there's a difference there. Both bills allow for the removal of the alternative minimum tax, so that goes away regardless of which bill gets adopted. And I mentioned that the Senate had some changes in their bill to quote-unquote save money, so that they could put certain things back into the bill for individuals that the House bill took out. Amongst those would be deductions for student loans and medical expenses. The House bill eliminated the deductions for those. The Senate bill put them back in. The House bill eliminates deductions for state and local income taxes, except for a $10,000 maximum deduction for real estate taxes, property taxes, whereas the Senate bill eliminates all of that. And we already talked about the estate tax. And here's the biggest item that probably warrants more discussion than anything else in the whole tax bill, because so much of it will change, and that is the Senate bill eliminates the individual mandate to purchase health insurance.
Interesting.
Yeah. And their argument is, hey, it's a tax.
The Supreme Court, goes in a tax bill.
The Supreme Court told us it was a tax, so we're going to change it, and they eliminate it. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I mean, I think it's a good idea to do that, because I think it helps to sabotage Obamacare, which the Republicans deny, but they all know that it's true. And the quicker we sabotage and destroy Obamacare, the quicker we can get something better to replace it. But they don't want to admit they're sabotaging it. So they say, no, we're not doing that. We're just eliminating a very onerous tax. It's the most egregious. It's the most despised portion of Obamacare amongst the public, and we're getting rid of it. The Democrats argue, oh, but you're going to throw 13 million people off of their health insurance.
I mean, they're literally not, though.
No, they're basically allowing people to opt out of buying health insurance. They say they're going to throw 13 million people off their health insurance. No, there's going to be millions of people that are not going to say, oh, I don't have to buy that crappy insurance anymore.
Yeah.
Because I won't have to pay the penalty instead. The problem in my mind is it opens up a whole new line of argument for some of these Republican senators who you don't know how they're going to respond to this. Are they going to, like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, for instance, the ones that stood in the way of repealing Obamacare.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that this individual mandate was one of the keystones that was holding Obamacare together. The fact that people had to buy insurance or they'd have to pay a penalty to the IRS to basically compensate the insurance companies for the ban on higher premiums for pre-existing conditions. Like, this was, again, one of the cornerstones that's holding the whole thing together. So, I mean, I completely agree that it's one of the most onerous parts of it. It's one of the most constitutionally abhorrent parts of it. It's one of the worst parts of it, you know, just to simplify the adjectives there. But, like, at the end of the day, you know, what are the ramifications going to be? What are the consequences going to be? I mean, it's kind of like the whole question that we were asked at one point, probably in like the first, second or third episode of the show, about would you push Rothbard's button to completely remove the government? It's just like, you know, it sounds nice in theory, but like the rest of society, and in this case, the rest of Obamacare and the rest of the government are still going to be there. You know, what are the ramifications going to be? What are the consequences going to be if, you know, all the other rules and spending and regulations are there regarding Obamacare, but the only thing that's gone now is the individual mandate? I mean, I don't know that I'm necessarily opposed to it for that reason. Like, it's kind of just like, you know, I don't care. Like, I think the country's kind of fucked anyway. We might as well start pulling pieces out of it and watch where the bricks fall. So like, okay, fine. But, you know, the idea that, you know, supposedly responsible statesmen and politicians are proposing this is a little bit of an interesting situation that we're in.
I think we'll have to wait and see how the negotiations go. I suspect that some Republicans will balk at this being included, but maybe they'll acquiesce to it if this Patty Murray, Lamar Alexander bill gets passed, which has something to do with reinstating these CSR payments. So
as long as they reinstate the CSR payments, they can cut the mandate. Like,
well, I don't know.
This is kind of what I'm getting at here in terms of like, okay, this is just going to explode the deficit in so many different ways.
My point is, it's another complicating element, and we don't know how it'll play out. Or maybe they put this in the bill, and if they find out that there are too many Republican senators that balk at it, it comes back out of the bill. In other words, in order to get the 51 votes that they need, they say, okay, well, we'll abandon this. You know, if that's what it takes to win over Susan Collins. I think Lisa Murkowski is pretty much being bought off, because my understanding is included in this tax bill is legislation that opens up the Arctic wildlife to drilling. So I'm shocked that we haven't heard more stuff from the environmentalists about that. You know, the Democrats are...
Especially with the Keystone Pipeline blowing up, where like they've basically got a pretty strong argument at this point that there's no way that you can possibly safely do anything involving oil.
Yeah, blow up. It's wrong link. I don't know how bad it is, but yeah. But you're right. Why haven't we heard more about that? I'm kind of surprised.
I mean, the argument writes itself. Like, if I'm a tree hugger environmentalist, you want to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge? Look what happened to the Keystone Pipeline. Tell me you're not going to destroy this pristine and beautiful environment. Yeah, right.
I'm just saying, I don't
Greenpeace,
know why
you're falling down on your game.
I don't know why we haven't heard that argument more. Maybe they've got so many other things. Maybe they're too busy talking about Russia and
that must be it.
Trump grabbing women by the... Anyway. So it's going to be an interesting several weeks after the Thanksgiving break to see what happens with this tax bill. The bottom line is there are a number of reasons why Republicans might not be able to pass it. We haven't even mentioned that some of the people who are maybe no's are objecting because it does, in fact, raise the deficit. People like Jeff Flake and Bob Corker are reputed to be against it because they're concerned about what it actually does to the deficit. So actually, shock of shocks, there are actually still some Republicans who are concerned about that, but that they happen to be the Republicans who've already announced that they're not going to run for re-election. So anybody that's worried about their seat, and McCain the same way. So that, you know, one guy that's on his last legs and two guys that are quitting the Senate may be the ones that stand up and say, no, we're still deficit hawks. We won't abide this. We'll see what happens. It's time to move on.
I have been married to my husband, Judge Roy Moore, for over 32 years. He was a graduate of West Point. He served our country in Vietnam, and he has always been an officer and a gentleman. He is a loving father and a grandfather. And most important, he is a Christian. So let me set the record straight. Even after all the attacks against me, against my family, against the foundation, and now against my husband, he will not step down. Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. We do not have permission from Tom Petty to use this song with that. In that context,
we never ask for permission. We're just planning on asking for forgiveness if the need ever arises. Last week, we were speculating on how the Republicans might save their bacon. And one of the things that went through my mind, at least, was that if they can talk Roy Moore into abandoning his run for the Senate and somebody to take his place that was overwhelmingly appreciated in Alabama, like Jeff Sessions, for instance, that they could successfully mount a write-in campaign. I think that is now off the table because there's no way that that could happen unless Moore says, okay, obviously I've screwed the pooch here. I'll get out of the race. He's decided that he's doubling down, and so that's not going to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
So I still think it's not over. I think there's a chance that Roy Moore pulls this out. But we'll have to see what the polls do in the next.
If Roy Moore pulls it out, though, like 2018 is going to be a Democratic landslide year.
Well, that's what we were saying last week, but now things have changed yet again because now there's Al Franken in the mix. So, in other words, yeah, the Democrats could say, "Oh, you know, you guys are elected a pedophile, or he's, you know, a terrible abuser of women." But what do they? How do they make that argument if Al Franken is still in the Senate, or and indeed Bob Menendez?
Because what about ism?
Yes, but the point is, it nullifies the argument that the Democrats would make. If it was just going to be about Roy Moore, if he gets elected, how bad it would be for the Republicans, that's one thing. But you know, we've had a couple of other elements introduced now.
Okay, so I saw that there was some shit going on about Al Franken. What exactly were the details of that? Like, clarify those details for me to the extent that you've been paying attention to them. Is that in here?
Yeah, it is. Al Franken is accused by a woman named Leanne Tweeden of groping her and forcibly kissing her against her will when they were on a USO tour, I think in 2006, if I'm not mistaken. The circumstances.
She was an adult?
Yeah, she's an adult.
Okay.
She was one of the MCs of the show, and Franken, this is before he was a senator, was putting together some kind of a skit, and it involved him kissing her. And he kept insisting that they should rehearse. And she said, we don't need to rehearse this because she knew what he really wanted. He insisted. So she finally said, okay, fine. She had anticipated that she would just turn her head when he went to kiss her, which is what she would have done on stage, she claims. But instead, when they were rehearsing, Franken grabbed her, put his hand behind the back of her head, and forcibly kissed her and put his tongue in her mouth. A very aggressive kiss from the decision. That's part of the accusation. And then the rest of the accusation was that Franken took a photograph of him either actually fondling her breasts or pretending to fondle her breasts while she was sleeping on board the C-17 on the way back to the United States from the show. And that's the photograph that's making the rounds. So it's one thing to accuse Roy Moore of this and accuse Roy Moore of that, but there's actually a photograph of Franken, if not actually groping her, then at least pretending to grope her. He has apologized. He says he'd be willing to submit to an ethics investigation. So, you know, you can argue he's been more forthcoming than Roy Moore has.
I would argue that.
And you could argue that what he did maybe wasn't as bad as what Roy Moore is accused of having done. But the point is, but there's a picture.
Yeah.
Let me read you there's a quote from an article in the National Review. I'm going to read the whole thing here. If Franken remains, Roy Moore's chances of victory in Alabama increase. It makes it too easy for Republicans in Alabama to say, wait a minute, we're supposed to end the career of Roy Moore, a legend in the state, when Democrats won't expel Franken? Why should we agree to unilateral ethics enforcement? Should Moore make it to the Senate, Democrats will be able to cast Republicans as the party of sex creeps only if they expel Franken. Every time Moore's name is mentioned, the response will be, what about Al Franken? And by the way, what about Bill Clinton and Ted Kennedy? And I would add Bob Menendez. Keeping Franken in the Senate provides cover for Roy Moore if he is elected. The other thing that article mentions that I thought was important because of the fact that it's a picture, it says, it, the grope picture, is to the sex war what the picture of the summary execution of that Viet Cong prisoner was to the Vietnam War. I thought that was an interesting analogy. I don't think it's quite as damning as that Vietnam picture, but yeah. I see their point. Again, it's a picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's easier to sell.
It's worth 1,000 words.
Yeah. So, like I said, I've taken a whole new stance on what Roy Moore's prospects are going forward based on that. And I've checked some of the...
From an objective standpoint, though, like not getting into the academic and, you know, newsworthiness and interestingness of talking about the clusterfuck that is American politics, they should both get out of the Senate. There's really no use for either of them being statesmen and representatives of their respective states.
Well, like, here's the thing. If Franken is expelled from the Senate by his colleagues, That's a freebie because, and they'll say, see, we're acting on principle. But in reality, if Franken gets expelled, he comes from a Democratic state, the governor of Minnesota will simply appoint another Democrat.
Yeah.
So there's no, you know, they can say, look, we're taking the high road, but that'll be bullshit if they decide to do that.
Again, going back to the academics of it, like, yeah, they should definitely do that. My point, though, is that Roy Moore, irregardless of whether or not he was groping little girls 30 years ago, and Al Franken, irregardless of whether or not he was groping whoever this woman is, you know, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, neither one of them are particularly valuable contributions to American politics.
David French, who writes for the National Review, among other things, says that they should get rid of Roy Moore, that he hopes he's defeated, and the Republicans should do everything they can to ensure that he's defeated, even though they lose a seat. It's a matter of party hygiene, is the way he calls it.
Yeah.
And he specifically means we don't want to give Bannon a win, because if Roy Moore succeeds, that means Bannon come back and claims that our guy won, we're going to drain the swamp, and that basically gives them leverage against every other Republican. And you may not feel so terrible about this, but basically it's more likely to harm the Republican Party. Whereas if they defeat Roy Moore, in the long run, the party benefits because they don't have Bannon to put up with anymore.
Well, I've said this in the past, and I don't remember exactly what the context was, but it's incumbent on political parties to police their own crazies. And Roy Moore is one of the Republican Party's crazies. And again, this is irregardless of whether or not he's fondling little girls 30 years ago. Like, the dude's an asshole. He's an asshole, he's a fuck-up, he's a piece of shit, he's a somebody who I do not want representing anybody in this entire country. So, like, I got no use for Roy Moore even before he started, you know, being called out for fondling little girls 30 years ago. Like, that's not the straw that broke the camel's back for me when it comes to Roy Moore. So, like, I'm not going to lose any sleep whatsoever over Roy Moore, you know, not making it to the Senate, and it's got nothing to do with, you know, these allegations that just came out. But, you know, I definitely agree with that statement about, you know, this is an issue of party hygiene. Like, the Republican Party should have been policing these kind of nutcases for years. And again, not just because they're fondling little girls, but because they're legitimately sons of bitches.
Well, I think you argue that the party has tried to police the party because...
No, they haven't.
Mitch McConnell, from the very word, from the get-go, was saying, we don't support this guy. They endorsed Luther Strange. I think the party did everything they could, and even they got Trump to endorse Luther Strange. The party did everything. You can't blame the Republican Party for this. The party did everything they could
marginalize.
No. Well, you can because
no,
you're not.
I'm going to tell you why. Because the Republican Party has for, you know, 30, 40 years before Roy Moore was the current problem of the day, been promoting this particular faction within its own ranks. Like, the nut jobs, screwball evangelicals have been ascendant in the Republican Party since the days of Nixon. Like, this is not a recent phenomenon. Like, yeah, okay, maybe Mitch McConnell is trying to bail out the sinking ship, but Richard Nixon already poked a hole in the hull.
Well, now you're opening up a different line of attack here. You're saying that you don't want evangelicals to be part of the Republican
I'm not saying evangelicals
that's
generally.
That's not your choice to make.
I'm not saying evangelicals generally. I'm saying the particular Roy Moore brand of evangelical, and that's an extreme past extreme. Like, you can be evangelical without being Roy Moore.
I'm not sure you can in Alabama, but okay.
No.
Anyway, regardless
in which
of
case,
what we think...
Regardless, that's why I'm saying it's incumbent on the Republican Party to police their own, and the fact that they haven't for 40 years is on them.
Well, I disagree. I think they've made an effort to do that, especially in regards to Roy Moore, but it apparently isn't working out. And clearly, Roy Moore has made a decision that he's got nothing to lose by pursuing this and everything to win. I took the opportunity to look at some of the polling numbers because the news is actually talking about how the numbers have turned against Roy Moore, that his Democratic opponent, Doug Jones, is actually leading in some of the polls right now. Personally, I doubt that those polls are valid, but they could be.
Those are the same polls that said Hillary Clinton was going to win the presidential
election.
That's
my point, exactly. And, you know, a lot of people, when they talk to a pollster, they may not be too eager to say, yeah, I'm going to vote for the guy that's been accused of molesting 14-year-old girls. But in their heart of hearts, they're saying, but I'm sure as hell not going to vote for that Democrat who is, you know, pro-abortion and pro-LGBT and pro-transgender bathrooms and whatnot. So, anyway, looking at the poll numbers, back in Sunday, thank you, Julia.
She's contributing.
A week ago Sunday, the 12th of November.
All right. Yes, we hear you.
The Emerson poll showed Roy Moore ahead by 10. There was another poll by JMC Analytics that showed Jones ahead by 4. Tuesday, the Fox 10 poll showed Moore ahead by 6. And then after that, things seemed to change a little bit. On Thursday, there was a Fox News poll that gave Jones it by 8 points. And Friday, a Gravis poll that showed Jones ahead by 5. So if you want to try to read between the lines here, it seems as though the polls are suggesting that the momentum has shifted for Roy Moore against Roy Moore and in favor of Jones. But again, that's if you can believe the polls, and that's the question that we have to ask. And I think it was Friday, the governor of Alabama, Kay Ivey, a woman, came out and says she believes the women accusers, but she will still vote for Roy Moore.
Like, who does that really benefit, though? Does that benefit Roy Moore, or does that benefit anybody other than Republicans?
That benefits Roy Moore. That's my point. I'm suggesting to you that, oh, everybody wrote Roy Moore off. He can't possibly win. And I'm suggesting to you that this is Alabama, and he's holding fast just the way Trump did after the Access Hollywood tape. And at the end of the day, people said, may be a child abuser, but he's not a Democrat, and I'd rather have a child abuser than a Democrat. And I'm just telling you,
Jesus
you're
Christ.
Laughing. You're laughing, but I'm suggesting to you that the reality of how this politically will play out is that Roy Moore could very easily still win.
Okay, but my point is that there's like even with Donald Trump, there's a difference. Like Donald Trump at least tried to justify what he was saying. Like, oh, it's locker room talk. I never actually did it. Like this governor of Alabama is basically saying, yeah, I completely believe that that's exactly what he did. I'm voting for him anyway.
Well, keep in mind Roy Moore is saying. Roy
literally saying, I would rather have a child abuser than a Democrat.
Let me play this soundbite from Sarah Huckabee Sanders at the podium at the White House when asked, what's the difference between Trump and his accusers and Roy Moore? Anyway, let me play this. It doesn't hold water here.
Is it fair to investigate Al Franken and the allegation made by his accuser? Is it also fair to investigate this president and the allegations of sexual misconduct made against him by more than a dozen women?
Look, I think that this was covered pretty extensively during the campaign. We addressed that then. The American people, I think, spoke very loud and clear when they elected this president.
But how is this different?
I think in one case specifically, Senator Franken has admitted wrongdoing and the president hasn't. I think that's a very clear distinction.
So she's saying we shouldn't bother talking about Trump anymore because he denied it.
Fair enough.
So we don't need an investigation of Trump because he denied it.
Trump's not a pathological liar or anything. If he said no, we should completely take his word for it. Whereas if Al Franken admitted, yeah, I fucked up, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. Anyway, I just thought I'd play that.
Again, that just kind of goes back to my whole thing. Like, I think the Republicans come out looking like idiots and all this. Like, yeah, maybe Roy Moore still wins Alabama. But like I said, that's gonna write Democratic campaign ads for 2018. Because, like, yeah, you know, Republicans can be like, well, what about Al Franken? What about Bill Clinton? What about this, that, and the other thing? But Bill Clinton's not on the ballot, first of all. Okay, like, Ted Kennedy's dead. Bill Clinton's not on the ballot. He may be dead by 2018, too. I mean, the guy's not looking well. Regardless, point is, like, Al Franken's admitted wrongdoing. He's like, yeah, I fucked up. That was a mistake. Sorry about that. And worst case scenario, he resigns and Minnesota appoints another Democrat to replace him.
I don't
Whereas
disagree with you.
Whereas when it comes to Roy Moore, you got a Republican saying, yeah, I totally believe he's a child molester. I'm voting for him anyway because at least he's not a goddamn Democrat. Like, independents do not buy that crap. Swing voters do not buy that crap. Swing voters are turned off by that. Swing voters are abhorred and disgusted
by
that sort of shit.
You've lost sight of the fact that this is Alabama, so I'm sure there are some swing voters.
Okay, fine, it's Alabama,
but the state is overwhelmingly a red state.
We're not talking about Alabama anymore. We're talking about 2018 in the midterm elections in swing states and what's going to happen for real as far as holding on to Congress, because the Republicans at this point have a majority in both houses. They are going to lose it if Roy Moore ends up in the United States Senate.
Last week?
Because the what about Al Franken thing isn't going to carry water.
Last week, I would have agreed with you wholeheartedly. This week, I'm simply suggesting there's another element to be considered, and it's possible that they dodge the bullet, even if Roy Moore wins.
I will,
especially if Roy Moore wins and immediately is subject to an ethics investigation, which is what they're talking about doing. There are cards that the Republicans can play where this doesn't wipe them out electorally in 2018.
Grant you that Al Franken is a mitigating factor, but I don't think he does it. I don't think he can care, because, like, again, he admitted wrongdoing. He can resign and be replaced by another Democrat, and it completely destroys the entire fucking argument. And you've got Republicans on the record. oh, I know he's, I'm sure, I believe it. I absolutely believe he's a child abuser, but, you know, he's, at least he's not a goddamn, like, that is not going to, that
you
is,
you don't have any
that
mainstream, no. You do not have mainstream Republicans saying that. You have some Republicans in Alabama saying that. You do not have, you certainly don't have any people in the Senate that are saying that.
And I mean,
so you've
good for them.
You've mischaracterized the status of the argument.
She won a statewide election. Like, this is, we're talking about a governor of a state.
Right.
That's again, that's not going to play with the rest of the country. That doesn't play. Like, it plays in Alabama, sure, but it doesn't play anywhere else.
You seem like you keep shifting the argument. Are we talking about Alabama, or are we talking about 2018?
We're talking about 2018.
Okay,
in 2018, people are going to, like, when I'm talking about writing their campaign ads for them, like, they're going to play this governor saying that over and over and over again. Yeah, he may be a child molester, but at least he's not a goddamn Democrat. Is that the party you want running running Congress? Why don't you vote for the Democrat? Like, seriously, that's the campaign ad right there. I just did it for you.
I think that's going to be less effective in view of the fact that the Senate has done everything they can to limit Roy Moore's chances. And I agree with you about Franken that, you know, what he did probably isn't as bad and that he shouldn't necessarily lose his job over it. But even if he does, as you said, what difference does it make? They'll just get another Democrat. Anyway, we need to move on.
I know you want to move on, but like, I don't want to try to discount what Al Franken did, but like, let's be honest with ourselves as an adult, and it's one as opposed to, you know, six or seven children. Now we can move on. Sorry.
I'm going to play this brief soundbite from Jeff Sessions. He was addressing the Federalist Society, and he was cracking some jokes. So not something you'd expect to hear from Jeff Sessions.
Jeff Sessions got jokes.
Is Ambassador Kislyak in the room? Before I get started here. Any Russians? Anybody been to Russia? Got a cousin in Russia or something?
It's time for the Macro Matters segment, our money segment on Radio Free America. Markets had kind of a tame week, especially compared to last week. Last week, there were five or six all-time closing highs in the several indices, the NASDAQ, the S&P, and the Dow. This week, there was only one. There was an all-time closing high in the NASDAQ on Thursday of 67.93.29. Other than that, a fairly calm week in the markets. The S&P was down only slightly. 0.13% down for the week. Gold and silver had decent weeks. Gold was up almost 1.5% at $1,294.50. Silver was up about 2.33% at $1,733. We should mention that Bitcoin is continuing its upward climb. As I'm recording this on Saturday afternoon, the 18th of November, Bitcoin was at $76,6201, representing a 21% increase from last week. That's 673% up from the beginning of the year, so almost seven times. Of course, by the time we get to recording the rest of the show on Sunday, who knows where it will be. It could be 1,000 points removed from the 76,62 that it stands currently. I think at one point it actually reached close to 8,000, so very volatile. It's basically crazy town in Bitcoin world. So as we've mentioned before, I missed that boat, and I'm not going to climb aboard now. There was a fair amount of economic news, some macro news during the course of the week. On Monday, we got budget information from the Treasury. We actually get a monthly figure from the Treasury on what the deficit is doing. The Treasury opens its fiscal year, October 2018, with a budget deficit of $63.2 billion. That's just for the month of October. That's a 37.9% increase from the same time last year. These outlays were driven primarily by a 14% increase in defense spending to $59.6 billion for the month. And here's the one that I noticed, the 21.6% year-on-year increase in net interest expenses to $28.6 billion. That strikes me as significant as that number rises, because right now interest rates are fairly low. Our large debt and large deficits are reasonably manageable still because interest rates are so low. What's going to happen to those numbers as interest rates rise? I suspect that bodes ill for our future. Just to let you know what the Treasury closed at in terms of their deficit for the full year 2017, they ended that year with a $665.7 billion deficit. That's two-thirds of $1 trillion tacked on to the existing, what is it, $3 or $4 trillion, lost track, debt that we have incurred. That represents a 13.7% increase from fiscal year 2016. Not going in the proper direction. There was some fairly good data as far as the performance of the economy during the past week. We got retail sales numbers on Wednesday, and although they were significantly lower than the previous month's numbers had been skewed heavily upward because of hurricane-related spending. The expectation is still for a buoyant November and December. On Thursday, we got jobless claims, which came in at 249,000 for the previous week. That's at the top end of the consensus range and 10,000 higher than the previous week, but still consistent with a steady downward trend since at least the middle of 2015. So the employment picture is looking fairly strong. We got industrial production numbers on Thursday as well. That rose 0.9% from the previous month, almost doubling consensus expectations. The manufacturing component of industrial production rose 1.3% from the previous month. Those numbers are quite strong and quite positive. And to go along with the positive growth, we also got some fairly good numbers on inflation. Good if you're someone who goes to the store and spends money, not good if you're the Fed. The Fed wants to see higher inflation. We got the producer price index numbers on Tuesday and the consumer price index numbers on Wednesday, and they show fairly tame inflation. The year-over-year numbers for consumer prices was down to 2% year-over-year from the previous month's 2.2%. So those numbers are positive if you're someone who actually goes to the store and spends money. And that's money. So we're running out of time here. We usually do a pop culture portion of the show. And this week I wanted to focus on the death of Malcolm Young of AC/DC. He died yesterday at the age of 64. He died from complications of dementia, which is odd. I didn't know that he was suffering from dementia. He actually retired from the band in 2014, so he hasn't been playing with them since then. It's been 2 or 3 years. Malcolm Young founded the band with his younger brother Angus in Australia in 1973, so they've been rocking for 44 years. That's a long time when you think about it. Actually, in 2008, Angus Young, his brother, noticed that his brother was having difficulty remembering songs that he'd played for 30 years. He actually last performed with the band in 2010. So we're going to play some music going out here, a little bit of AC/DC, and I asked Will.
Before we do that, just a quick reminder to everybody that the Kent County Libertarian Party meeting is going to be tomorrow, the 20th of November at 7 o'clock p.m. at Thank Giacomo's you. On Route 8 in Dover. So anybody who's interested in that, please come out. We'd be happy to have you. And with that, AC/DC.
I'll let you pick the song. Well, what's it going to be?
Let's do Back in Black.
Okay, Back in Black it is. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.